I want to begin by saying that I find myself, and I hope that you will, find yourself in hearty agreement with the doctrinal understanding of the Scriptures that the writer of Pilgrim's Progress has, his understanding of the doctrines, the gospel, and especially of Christian sanctification. That's really the basic subject of Pilgrim's Progress, is Christian sanctification. It's one of the reasons I want us to study it. This is really one of the, along with repentance, one of the missing notes in modern day preaching is sanctification. And so I want you to know I agree wholeheartedly with most everything that John Bunyan teaches in this book. And when we come to that one thing that I don't agree with, and it's not even in the book, but I want you to know, I'll tell you about it. So, let's begin with some dates. And there are many dates here that I could give, but I want to limit these to just a few. We need to locate John Bunyan in history, first of all. John Bunyan was not, Pilgrim's Progress was not written in the 21st century. It was written a long time ago by a man who lived a long time ago. So let's begin with the dates of John Bunyan's life. John Bunyan is the author. He lived from 1628 to 1688. 1628 to 1688. And he was born at a place called Elstow in Bedfordshire. Now, that doesn't help me one bit. All I know is that's in England. And I could not find an acceptable map, or I would have shown you that on the map. But we'll come back to some of the dates in Bunyan's life later, but I want to point out that one of the main experiences in his life was a 12-year period from 1660 to 1672. 1660 to 1672. John Bunyan was put in prison, and he did most of these 12 years. He served most of these 12 years in the prison. Now, here's what he was charged with. He was charged for leading an unlawful religious assembly. That's something Americans can't even conceive of today. In other words, what he was doing, he was a Baptist preacher, and the state church was the Church of England, the Anglicans, and so they had some Baptist services, and they threw him in jail. You can't do that. And so while he was in prison, and this is one of the most pitiful things that I can think of, while he was in prison, he supported his family. He had a family. He supported them by, of all things, making shoelaces. That's all he could do. There wasn't any material to make anything else out of much. But he made shoelaces, and people, I understand, they brought him the material to do that with. He also preached to the inmates while he was there. And probably a lot of them wished they had never got put in the same cell with this Baptist preacher. But it was the biggest blessing they ever had in their lives. And he spent a lot of his time in prison writing. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. And the fact that John Bunyan got put in prison unjustly, we would have just probably thrown up our hands and couldn't believe how unjust it was. But he used it to write Pilgrim's Progress. And he probably wrote it during the years of 67 to 72. Those years, the later years, while he was in prison. In 1677, he got put back in prison again. Now remember, he's not disturbing the peace. He's not robbing banks. He's preaching the gospel in a Baptist assembly. In 1678, this is a very important date. The book that we're studying, Pilgrim's Progress, was published. 1678, first first published in that year, 1678. And then in 1688, he died. 1688, John Bunyan died. Now, he is buried in a place in London called Bunnell Fields. Have you ever been there, Rebecca? I wonder if your dad's ever been there. My father and mother went there, and I should have thought to bring this picture, have a picture of them standing there by Bunyan's grave. And Charles Spurgeon's buried in the same cemetery, and a whole lot of other great men of God, as well as famous people, are buried there in a place called Bunnell Fields. All right, so that gives you some idea of the time frame we're talking about. Now, 1628 is 8 years after the pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. It gives you an idea of the time frame. That's a long time ago. And so, anyway, I want to start by, after the dates, by talking about the universal appeal of this book. This book, The Pilgrim's Progress, is popular worldwide. It is unsurpassed by any other English literary work. If you've ever had English literature, you have to come to grips with Pilgrim's Progress. Most modern-day English teachers probably hate it because of its theology, but they have to recognize its literary value. It is, as far as literature, it is an allegory. An allegory. That's the type of literature it is. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But it teaches and enforces the whole saving truth of the gospel. Someone said this is the best summary of evangelical doctrine ever produced by a writer not miraculously inspired. And I believe that's right. It's second only to the Bible. It has reverently been described as the second best book in all the world. I think this is going too far, but some have even described it as the poor man's Bible. I think it's wrong to put anything on the level of the Word of God, but that does show you that it is the second best book in the world. This period of time is part of what is called the English Puritan era in history. Many of the great Puritans lived during this time. We'll come back to this later, but John Bunyan's best friend was the famous Puritan whose name is John Owen. I have the works of John Owen. I read them a lot. He's one of the greatest theologians and theological writers in history, I believe, and John Bunyan was a personal friend of his. John Bunyan has written other books we want to talk about. One of them is called Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. And I had that book somewhere, but I couldn't find it. I was going to bring it and show it to you. But this book is his autobiography. It tells about his spiritual experiences in life. Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. He has a style that many believe he borrowed from Fox's Book of Martyrs and the English Bible. He was highly influenced by the writing style of these. How many of you have ever read Fox's Book of Martyrs? All right, some of you have read that. It's really hard to get through that book, not because of its literary style, but because of how horrible it is. But he borrowed much of his style from that. Of course, his subject matter is a lot different. But also, an interesting sidelight, Charles Spurgeon lived in the mid to late 1800s, 200 years later, and he read, by his own testimony, he read Pilgrim's Progress 100 times. Now, that shows you how important it is, and no doubt it had a tremendous influence on the great preaching of Charles Spurgeon. for over 300 years since the first edition, Pilgrim's Progress has captivated the whole world in spite of its militantly non-Catholic style, its uncompromising honesty, and above all, its thorough biblicality. Those are the things that have made it popular. It's been translated into over 190 languages. Has challenged the imagination of innumerable artists. And I have somebody showed me an old edition of Pilgrim's Progress, and some artist had painted pictures of most of the great major scenes in there. And it's very interesting that so many artists have been challenged. I've never seen an artist bring it up to date in, make, you know, the dress of the 21st century and all of that. That'd be interesting, too, to see someone do that. But someone has said that its enduring influence still humbles proud and boastful mankind by declaring what God has wrought through a tinker's pen unto the praise of His glory. Now, we'll talk about a tinker here in just a moment. Let's talk about the attitude we need to have in studying this book. First of all, it's not the Word of God. And so it's not the final authority, and we don't promote it like that. Primarily, this book is concerned with the indifferent and the godless people in this world, as well as, and this is where it hits many today, the casual and nominal Christians or believers. Bunyan wanted to turn the carelessness of the Christians of his day into passionate concern for the pursuit of the kingdom of the Lord Jesus Christ. And there is a poem in the introductory area of this book, Pilgrim's Progress. It's called The Author's Apology for his book. And one of the verses in this poem, Bunyan gives his reason for writing, and it's very interesting. Art thou for something rare and profitable? Wouldst thou see a truth within a fable? Art thou forgetful? Wouldst thou remember from New Year's Day to the last of December? Then read my fancies. They will stick like burrs, and maybe to the helpless comforters. This book is writ in such a dialect as may the minds of listless men affect. It seems a novelty, and yet contains nothing but sound and honest gospel strains. Now, that's not so hard to comprehend, is it? We need to apply our minds. People were a lot more serious in those days. And John Bunyan went to maybe 6 weeks of school in his entire life, and yet this book is far above most of our literary abilities. It says a lot about our school systems today and the education that we have. But anyway, as I said earlier, this book is an allegory. And the purpose of his allegory is he desires that our fascination with the stories he tells be transformed into the most serious quest for the righteousness of God. Even after the models, he wants us to model our quest for the righteousness of God after three characters: Christian, faithful, and hopeful. And we'll come across these as we read. At the end of part one, now if you may not know that this book is divided into two parts. The first one is a man named Christian and his trip to heaven, the celestial city. His wife wouldn't go with him. But at the close of that section, he starts part two, and that's Christiana, his wife, and she starts on her journey to heaven. And so at the close of part one, here is a very serious challenge that Bunyan offers. Now, reader, I have told my dream to thee. See if thou canst interpret it to me, or to thyself, or neighbor. But take heed of misinterpreting, for that instead of doing good will but thyself abuse. By misinterpreting, evil ensues. Take heed also that thou be not extreme in playing with the outside of my dream, nor let my figure or similitude put thee into a laughter or a feud. Leave this for boys and fools. But as for thee, do thou the substance of my matter see. Put by the curtains, look within the veil, look within my veil. Turn up my metaphors, and do not fail. There, if thou seekest them, such things to find as will be helpful to an honest mind. What of my dross thou findest there, be bold to throw away, but yet preserve the gold. What if my gold be wrapped up in ore? None throws away the apple for the core. But if thou shalt cast all away as vain, I know not but 'twill make me dream again. Everything he says is kind of a poetic allegory like that. Now let's talk about Bunyan's spiritual purpose in this book. Whenever, and there have been many attempts in modern times to make theatrical productions out of Pilgrim's Progress, and by and large they've always failed. And it's for the same reason. They always focus on the visual and the fascinating instead of always at the expense of the doctrinal. And of course, you put something precious and spiritual like this into the hands of Hollywood TV producers, and it's like Solomon says in Proverbs, it's like putting a jewel of gold in a swine snout. They can't handle anything truly spiritual like this is. For Bunyan, his medium of allegory was just a means to an end. He just wanted another medium to get the gospel over and sanctification. He says we should have no desire to just toy with the outside dress of his dream. And many detached literary analysts try this today. I remember in college we studied literature, and they'd always get bogged down in the literary devices, and it never was a blessing, never made any sense, because they were missing the purpose. We're looking for substance in this study, and not what the book of Hebrews called mere shadows. We're looking for substance. We're looking for the flesh of concrete truth, as one commentator says. So let us truly thirst to know the living God and His glorious Son, Jesus Christ, through this study that we're going to make of Pilgrim's Progress. Now let's focus more on the author himself, the man, John Bunyan. We've given you the dates of 1628-1688. John Bunyan, first of all, was a Baptist preacher. Now, I know I'm reading a study guide to Pilgrim's Progress, and the author of this study guide just goes out of his way to downplay the fact that John Bunyan was a Baptist. You know, somehow these Reformed people and these Protestant people, Baptist, you know. They always look down on Baptist, and so this commentator is a Protestant, and he goes out of his way to downplay that he was a Baptist. But he was. And I thank the Lord that he was. He was a Baptist pastor. He was a preacher. And he was a prolific writer. He worked in the area around Bedfordshire and Cambridgeshire. You know where Cambridgeshire is? All right? Is that close to where you were? North of London. All right. So it wasn't too far away from London. But he traveled a lot. He was a traveling preacher. He pastored this church, but he traveled around as well. And so even though he was not a Baptist, they nicknamed him Bishop Bunyan because he had so much influence over so many churches. Now, I've got a picture here. And this is evidently, really is, a picture of John Bunyan. So I'm going to start one on this side and one on the other side. And if you'll just look at it quickly and pass it on, I want to describe what he looked like while you're looking at that picture. Here's what a man named George Ophir, who lived contemporarily with Bunyan, here's how he described him. It says, he appeared in countenance, or in his face, to be of a stern and rough temper. And you know, that's the way people nearly always come down on the Baptist preacher. The first time they look at him, they don't really look at him. They just think, oh, he doesn't have any fun. He's just, you know, he's all serious, sober side. Said his countenance seemed to be of a stern and rough temper. But in his conversation, when he got to know him better, he was mild and affable. He was not given to talkativeness. He was, unless something urgent came up that required him to do so, he didn't talk very much. He never boasted of himself. I'm sorry to say, I've been around some Baptist preachers that self is the number one subject, no matter what. It always comes back to, I have built so many buildings. I have been pastor of First Baptist Church of so-and-so. He didn't talk much about himself. And never boasted on himself. He absolutely hated lying and swearing. He had a good discernment of character. He could size somebody up by talking with them just a little bit and discern their character. That's an important thing for a preacher to have. He was tall in stature. And he was, this says, strong-boned, though not corpulent. So I assume that means he was large, but not fat. And he had a somewhat ruddy face. Must have had rosy cheeks or a reddish complexion. Sparkling eyes. And listen to how he says this. Wearing his hair on his upper lip. I guess that means he has a mustache. and his hair was reddish. That's interesting. He had red hair. But in his latter days, it began to be sprinkled with gray. And it happens to all of us, doesn't it? He had a moderately large mouth. His forehead was somewhat high. And his clothing was plain and modest. So that I'm really glad that fellow went to the trouble all those years ago to write that down. It gives you an idea of what he looked like. All right, let's locate him in history just a little bit more and talk about his life also. There was a lot of religious turbulence during his lifetime. Brother, I mean, it was just one big earthquake the whole time that he lived. The king, when he came into the world, was, was King Charles I. And he also, there was a bishop in the Church of England under Charles I that was very important because of his persecution of Baptists and other Protestants. And his name was Archbishop Laud, L-A-U-D. He was one of, Rasmussen was the arch villain of Russia. And he was a monk of the Greek Orthodox Church. But Bishop Laud, Archbishop Laud, was the arch villain of this period of time. His name was Laud, L-A-U-D. And Archbishop Laud persecuted the Protestants and the Baptists for two things, for their Calvinism and for their independence. He was so hard on these non-Anglican people that 20,000 immigrants left England while he was king and went to the colonies in New England. This man is one of the main reasons why the Pilgrims came to Plymouth, Archbishop Laud. And John Bunyan was drafted in the Civil War. Very interesting. he was just a kid. And when Archbishop Laud was finally executed, they had an uprising called, the Puritans rose up under Cromwell and overthrew the king, and they executed him in 1649. They also executed Archbishop Laud. And after that, about that time, he was drafted into the army. And there was introduced in Parliament, they introduced parliamentary rule, I should say, under Cromwell. The king was no longer the sole dictator. Parliament began to rule there, and Oliver Cromwell was called the Protector, the Lord Protector, but he was the I guess you'd say the Puritan leader of England, Cromwell. I'm very interested in that, and I wish we had time to go into it, but I just want to mention it in relation to John Bunyan. The interesting thing about Cromwell, under his government, they had Presbyterian government in the country. That parliamentary rule was Presbyterian. It's patterned after the Presbyterian Protestant form of government. Nonconformists, which were non-Catholics, their influence also played a big part in the government. But at this time, Bunyan was converted and baptized and received into membership of the Baptist congregation at Bedford. I'm going to come back and talk some more about him getting drafted here in a minute, but let's go with a general overview of his life first of all. He was married young, and his first wife died. She bore him four children before she died, and introduced him to his godly pastor, whose name was John Gifford. John Gifford had a tremendous influence on the life and the theology of John Bunyan. His name was Gifford. We had a fellow, a friend of mine in college named John Gifford. I never asked him if he had ever traced his family back that far. But anyway, John Bunyan started preaching in 1655. And he got into a dispute with the Quakers. Now, anybody that preached anything found himself in conflict with the Quakers. They were really something else. And his first published book, the title of it was Some Gospel Truths Opened, and it answered the Quakers and their heresies. Then after a while, Cromwell's rule ran its course and was overthrown, and they brought back the monarchy again. Charles II was the king. He came to power in 1660. And just a few months after that, Bunyan was arrested and imprisoned for his field preaching and for being an independent. While Charles II ruled, two great catastrophes hit England. There was the London Plague. One of the awfulest chapters in Western history. The plague hit England. It hit London, and thousands died. And then the next year, a great fire burned virtually the whole city of London to the ground. Another tremendous catastrophe. These are the times in which Bunyan labored and wrote. And during all this time, while these fires and everything were going on, the monarchy began to suppress Protestantism and Baptists again. And they came up with laws. One of these laws, very important in our study, was called the Uniformity Act, or the Act of Uniformity. Now, you can tell by the name of that something of where the Church of England was going. The Act of Uniformity required that all people must attend the Anglican Church or go to prison. How'd you like to live in a country like that? Everybody had to go to the Anglican Church. And then they came up with another important act of Parliament called the Conventicle Act. The Conventicle Act, and this declared that religious assemblies of five or more persons were only lawful within the Church of England. In other words, you couldn't have a home Bible study, or you couldn't have a church that didn't meet inside the walls of an Anglican building, or were not part of an Anglican church. Then they came up with another one called, and this is one they got John Bunyan on. It's called the 5 Mile Act. The 5 Mile Act. You can figure something from the title of that also. Non-Anglican preachers had to live at least 5 miles from a town. In other words, a Baptist preacher couldn't live within 5 miles of any town. That's a neat way to get rid of the Baptists, isn't it? Can't have any preachers. Couldn't live within 5 miles of a town. And so it was during all of this that Bunyan was put in prison and that he wrote Pilgrim's Progress. Now, after Charles II, King James II came to power, and he was trying to, his purpose was to bring the Church of England and the Catholic Church back together. And he was an ecumenical guy, and so the people revolted against the government again. They didn't want anything else to do with Catholicism. They had gotten rid of that way back before Charles I. And they didn't want anything else to do with that. And so King James II finally had to flee to France in 1688. And that was the year that John Bunyan preached his last sermon, 1688. And it was a sermon on John 1:13. I don't know how that's interesting that we know exactly the text and the sermon, the last one he preached. All right. Now, here's some more things about his life that are really interesting and important. He received what he described as a poor man's education. Here's a quote from his works called The Works of John Bunyan. Quote, "I never went to school to Aristotle or Plato, but was brought up at my father's house in a very mean or lowly condition among the company of poor countrymen." In other words, he was homeschooled. That comes out of his works. Now, this is volume 1. I have all 3 volumes of the works of John Bunyan. And you can tell what a prolific writer. This includes Pilgrim's Progress and all of his other books in these 3 volumes that I have. I don't see these for sale very often in anywhere, but they are available if you were to want to go that far and buy his entire works. Anyway, his trade. Let's talk about his trade. He had a trade, a way of making a living before the Lord called him to preach. And the name of his trade was that he was a tinker. Now, when I was a boy, I used to have some funny ideas. I thought a tinker meant he made tinker toys or he played with tinker toys. That's not what a tinker is. And it doesn't mean that he sat around in his workshop and piddled around with stuff and played with stuff. He was a tinker. He learned that from his father. And a tinker was a man who mended pots and pans. He repaired metal pots and pans. In other words, he was a metal worker and even to some extent a plumber. And he knew how to use his tools were hammer and forge. Sometimes people describe a tinker as a brazier. Now, you've heard the term, some plumbers use a torch and some stuff, and they call it brazing. What they do that to copper or brass? Copper. And so sometimes he is called a brazier. Anyway, he mended pots and so forth. His mother died right after his 16th birthday. And then his father almost immediately remarried, and this shook Bunyan to his very foundations. He had a hard time coping with this. And this is the time when he was mustered into the parliamentary army. Now, I want to tell you that story because it's so interesting. He was drafted at age 16, and, you know, even in World War II, they wouldn't take you till you were 18 unless you lied about it. A lot of them did, but you had to tell them you were 18. But He got drafted when he was 16, and they knew it. And so he just didn't have anything else to do. His mother was gone. His world had crumbled. And so he went. And he got involved in the military, in the army. And just as they were getting ready to go to battle, a man came to him and said, and bought his place. You know, and they still did this up into the American War Between the States. If you didn't want to go, you could sell your place to somebody else, or if you wanted to go, you could buy somebody's place and go. And so a man came, a man that had some money, and bought John Bunyan's place in the military. And he really wasn't against going, but this fellow wanted to go so bad that he bought it. Well, he immediately went into battle, and this man who bought his place was assigned to stand guard duty, to stand as a sentinel, a lookout, a watch at night. And the night before the siege, somebody on the other side, some sniper on the castle wall or someplace, took a pot shot at him, and he hit, and his musket bullet went through this man's head and killed him. And so that got Bunyan's attention. He said, "I would have been there if this man hadn't come along." And all of us have, from time to time, have experiences in life like that that ought to shake some sense into us or get our attention about where we stand with God. Well, that was the beginning of the Lord's working in the life of John Bunyan. After he got out of the military, he went back to tinkering in the little town Elstow. And at 20 years of age, he married this young lady who came to have a considerable influence on him. They came together. Both of them were as poor could be, poor as Job's turkey, my grandmother used to say. And they didn't have anything between them. They didn't even have any dishes or spoons when they got married. They had nothing but a couple of books that her father gave her when she got married. And these books were, the first one was The Plain Man's Pathway to Heaven by Arthur Dent. And the other one was The Practice of Piety by Lewis Bailey. And her father actually had left this to her when he died, shortly before they got married. And in these two books, they would, a lot of times at night they'd get together and he would read to her from these books, because that's all they had to do. There was nothing else to do. And he found a lot of things that were interesting and pleasing to him in the book, he admits. But he said, all the time, there was no conviction in my life at all. But the Lord had begun to work in his life at that time. Well, he was going to the Anglican Church. And for 4 years, he was just in a terrible turmoil in his life. He came to see how wrong the Anglicans were. They were still basically Catholics without a pope. I guess you could describe them that way. And he said he came through this in this four-year period. He regarded the high place, the priest, the clerk, the vestment, and the service with an adoration bordering on superstition. And yet he... in other words, he became very religious in that particular religion. But at the same time, he said, "Man, I had a hard time giving up my social life and my sports and my dancing and all of these worldly things that he was involved in." And yet, they gave him a job of ringing the bell at the church. He was the whatever they call the guy who rang the bell in the church. And so he began to have a real conflict in his life. He saw that these things didn't fit with biblical religion that he was doing. And one day he was cursing and swearing as loud and as bad as he possibly could. He said, "I was belching forth oaths like a madman." And all of a sudden a woman came by, and she had a bad reputation in the neighborhood herself. She was no paragon of moral virtue, but she said, "I tremble at the language you use, and you're going to ruin all the kids in this neighborhood, the way you're talking." And he said that that was a great humiliation to him. It really started him thinking about his life. And so he went home and began to read the Bible. We never know when taking a stand like that will have some kind of influence. I'll never forget when my grandfather Turner, my mother's father, came over to our house. I was about 10 or 11 years old. He came over to our house in Oklahoma City, and a bunch of the neighborhood boys were around. They were using all this slang. They weren't using out-and-out profanity, but they were using, it is profanity. They were saying darn and gosh and all that stuff. And my grandfather says, "Listen, boys, please don't talk like that around here. We're Christians, and we don't use that kind of language." And they just, what? It was like somebody hit them over the head with a mop or something, you know. And that really got me to thinking, too. It was a real witness to those guys. Nobody had ever told them you shouldn't talk like that. But anyway, John began to read his Bible, and he started to try to reform his life. And many people under conviction will do that. They start, "Well, I'm going to start living right. I'm going to start going to church. I'm going to start doing what I can." And so one day he was listening to a group of godly women. They didn't know he was listening. He was eavesdropping on them. And they were talking about the joy that they had in their heart over the new birth. And they were also talking about how sinful they were by nature. They didn't know anybody was listening. This was a private conversation. He said that he got under such conviction listening to that serious conversation that he was utterly shaken in his heart. And this godly testimony, even though he didn't ask for it and they didn't volunteer it, continued to haunt him and challenge him for the next several years. And so he began to search as never before for something in relation to God. He wrestled with countless questions that came up in his Bible study. And some of them like, "Do I have saving faith?" Good question for all of us to struggle with. "Can I perform a miracle?" Don't have to worry about that one. But serious people think about those things. "Am I one of God's elect?" That's a very important one to be thinking about. And then he had a dream in which he saw how lost and hopeless he was. And this also was used. Well, the next thing he did, has she rung that bell yet? Oh, my goodness, I didn't hear that bell. We'll have to stop there. I know she's awake back there anyway, don't I? We'll have to stop there. But next time, I think we might have one or two more studies of this background material. But it's very important, and I hope you'll stay with me. So we can get this good background of what is going on in this story. Any questions or comments? Only about what we studied today. All right. Be sure, and if you haven't done so already, start reading the introduction and read down to the end of the introductory poem. And we'll take up with that 2 weeks from today, if and when we finish the history here. All right, let's stand together for our word of prayer. Brother Johnny, would you please lead us as we pray?